And historically, you can go back to the Greeks. You find already those aspects more than 2,000 years ago, this commitment to self. Be well yourself before you treat the others. If you're unwell, you won't be able to treat the others. So for us, it's part of this core aspect of professionalism. And we expect them in the learning report at the end of the year that they reflect on their well-being.
Welcome to Flourishing in Medicine, from Surviving to Thriving. I'm your host, Dr. Mick Krasner. This podcast, produced by MPRO, a medical professional liability insurance carrier headquartered in New York State, is offered to you because of MPRO's deep commitment and track record of programs that support physicians they protect. This commitment includes many wonderful learning opportunities that they've developed, and I hope you enjoy this podcast and explore other of their offerings. Today, I'm really excited to share with you my conversation with Dr. Raphael Bonvin, who is Vice President and Professor of Medical Education at the University of Fribourg, Switzerland. He has committed his career to aligning medical education more closely with the skills and competencies required to be a physician. Recognizing the formative possibilities in designing educational assessments for learning purposes rather than just for grading, and central to his innovative and groundbreaking work in radically shifting medical education, is the importance of self-awareness and self-care as competencies that medical education must address in order for the future professionals to provide excellent care and to flourish in medicine. And now, our conversation with Raphael Bonvin. Welcome to Flourishing in Medicine. And what's interesting having you on now is that we're publishing several podcasts around this time that yours will be broadcast that have to do with medical education and its effects on flourishing with medical professionals. So we're really happy to have a professional, intentional, international renowned educator like you as a guest. So we'll begin. And I begin all these conversations with exploring what brought you into medicine. You know, in the experiences I've had with students, with clinicians, teachers, academics, I've been really impressed by the unique narratives. Sometimes there's some common threads in those narratives about why they chose to go into the health profession. Sometimes it's early, profound experiences. Sometimes it's something about serving humanity. Sometimes it's something that occurred during their educational journey or earlier on. So we'd really love to hear about your path, how you got to this, where you are now, and especially how you chose medicine of all the talents you have and all the things that you could choose. And please take your time. We're really interested in hearing about this.
Okay. Thanks, Mick. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast. Well, how did I enter medicine? Actually, I was undecided between going for physics, biochemistry, or medicine. So I was hugely interested in all three. And finally, I decided to go into medicine because of the humanistic dimension I envisioned to find in there. That was the moment I decided to enter medicine and leave physics and biochemistry by the side. And funny enough, we have in Switzerland a six-year curriculum, and the first 2 years are heavy on basic science. And I at one point got a little bit upset because there was just physics, chemistry, biochemistry. And first of all, it was boring for me because I was well established in those disciplines. And that's not why I was entering medicine. In parallel to starting medicine, I entered a traditional Chinese medicine school. And actually, that's the reason why I stayed in medicine, because I got what I was looking for medicine in this training of the traditional Chinese medicine. So this was a parallel track all over my studies with traditional Chinese medicine. And for the first 3 years, and the last 3 years there was some training in homeopathic medicine. So for me, that was the reason why I stayed in medicine. So I chose for the humanistic, was disappointed, and stayed in because I had something that showed me there is something at the end of the path.
Maybe you can unpack that a little more. What was it about that experience in training in Chinese, traditional Chinese medicine, that kept that humanistic drive alive in a way that the basic sciences in the undergraduate medical education experience did not? Be curious, what did you see? What did you feel? What was the experiences that kind of told you, oh yeah, this is about taking care of people and I'm in it and I know we'll get there in my traditional studies?
So I was already quite at ease in those basic science. I loved those basic science. So it was not that I was not fulfilled with this, but it was too easy, if I may say, for me. And I really chose not to go into that to discover something different. And so in the beginning of my medical studies, I didn't find that because there was so much of basic science. And what kept my enthusiasm in having chosen the path of taking care of some other people, of caring people, of trying to cure them, was this traditional Chinese medicine. Because we had already thoughts about a therapeutic approach. We had an approach of the patient that was holistic and not just some disease. So those are the things that nurtured my enthusiasm in staying in medicine.
Got it. So sounds like what you're describing, at least what I'm hearing, is that there was a very clear line connecting what you were doing in the traditional Chinese part of that medical education to the patient, whereas it was a little less clear learning the basic sciences. Naturally, they were more focused on mastering the basic sciences, although I would imagine they tried to bring in some connections with what it means for disease and health, that it was just more obvious and clear. You know, you've had many different paths, including the traditional Chinese medicine, but can you take us from the medical school experience to your choices and how you decided to focus your mission in life, if you will, on education, on medical education? You are a consummate, well-known medical educator who has had, you know, great impact on your own communities and others. So tell us about how you got there, knowing that there was this drive to be connected with the human condition.
So basically, it starts exactly in the experience I mentioned before, why I chose medicine. So I went through the whole school. I highly appreciated doing clinic. So I did some postgraduate training in clinic. And I really felt at ease, and that was my aim, and I was really full into it. But looking back, and also during my studies, I was not happy with how medicine was taught. Starting by the first year being so strange when you enter a clinical track that you don't have clinic. So that was kind of the start of my critique of how I was taught, and I was pretty sure we could improve that. So I had I was the chair of the student association. We looked at different aspects of our curriculum. We tried to raise our concerns and try to put that into movement. And there was a wise dean when he received our report that said, "I want you on my committee. We're going to do a study reform." And that's actually one path that brought me into medical education. The other path is that I did my doctorate thesis on teaching chest examination, lung auscultation, palpation, percussion. I loved those clinical exam moments. And I wanted to find a way to make it more accessible to my fellow student. So I developed, at that time, it was back in 1994, a CD-ROM, a teaching CD-ROM that was quite new. So I worked actually 2 years on developing this teaching program within the pneumology department at our hospital. And that's where I got the direct experience about teaching and my involvement. And in parallel, I worked on this study reform with the study reform committee. So that was my entering into medical education.
It's really fascinating how a recognition by a faculty mentor or someone can completely solidify and in some ways change a career path by identifying in you some aptitude and knowing that you were finding some meaning in that. This person brought you onto that reform committee, and then you could say, as the saying goes, the rest is history. Of course, you know, the path that was to follow, you know, continues to be influenced by many, many other experiences. But I think that's really great. To round out your kind of educational interests and clinical interests, before we come back to education, because I'm going to want to do that, is I'd like to hear a little bit about your curiosity and your training in some other areas. I know you're trained in hypnosis and also in acupuncture. I guess that could be related to the traditional Chinese medicine. But tell us a little bit about how that developed as well.
So hypnosis was something I did as an adolescent. And that was this magical approach of hypnosis and vision of hypnosis. And we tried some crazy stuff at that time, as you do when you're an adolescent with some friends. So we tried to anesthetize our skin and put some needles in and that kind of stuff. So that was a crazy moment of my hypnosis. I probably kept from that kind of, I befriended the idea that our mind is something more than some automatic approach. And from there on, when I started medicine, that was history, as you said before, I kind of forget it. But then it came back again. A brother of mine is a psychiatrist, and I didn't know at that time, but he invested in clinical hypnosis and was restructuring a clinical hypnosis school. He asked me to give him a hand from the education perspective, and the deal was, give me a hand and you're allowed to have the training for free. And that's how I came back to now with I was already a physician. I was clinically active at that time. I entered this world of hypnosis from another angle. And that's how I entered there. And that was the moment where I stopped being clinically active. And I was asked to teach some of those aspects, but I kept out of the clinical teaching of hypnosis because I didn't have any ongoing clinical experience. So I focused on self-hypnosis. And this is a teaching I did for more than 20 years now on a 1 or 2 day workshop for everyone. So from the gardener person to the oncologist, all people sit together in those trainings and we explore together what they can change in the perception on how they live their life.
And the acupuncture part of your training, is that part of the traditional Chinese experience?
So the acupuncture part was this traditional Chinese medicine training. I never practiced this after my training. It was for me more than a practical training, a training in considering different perspectives of what I call reality. For me, reality depends on how you look at it. So for me, it was this experience of saying, okay, there are different realities. When you look at the patient, if you put the grid of our scientific medicine, you have all the physiology, physiopathology, and the treatment that go with it. But if you put another look at the patient and you apply the traditional Chinese medicine perspective, then you have a whole other understanding of this physiology, this physiopathology, and the treatment that goes with it. So I learned, starting with my medicine, to have different perspective, and pretty much convinced from the beginning that depending on what's going on, one perspective is better than the other, but that's not an absolute perspective. It's not that one technique is good and the other is bad. It depends on the condition and the situation.
It sounds like these experiences, whether you're clinically active with them or not, have had a big influence on, you know, your main activity, which has been education, and your understanding of perspective taking, empathy, all those other aspects of what we want to train in our trainees and our students and physicians. And because this show is called Flourishing in Medicine, I'd like to come back to that focus on education and ask you to talk to our listeners about the connection, as you see it, between the learning environment and well-being. And I'll give you some other prompts that maybe can help you, maybe touching on the dynamics of assessment. I know that you've studied that and written about that, curriculum design, maybe if there's any evidence related to those aspects and how physicians choose make their career choices, the career path, and even burnout, the relationship between the learning environment and burnout. And then eventually, if we get to it, I'll prompt you if we go off on tangents, which is totally fine. But I'd really like you to talk a little bit about what you've brought to Fribourg, Switzerland, this new curriculum that I think really does have the opportunity to help students and future physicians flourish. And we'll come back to some parts of that I'd like to hear more about. So yeah, the connection, again, between the learning environment and well-being.
Yeah, I think it's a very important link for me and this perspective developed over time. Based my own experience, I went through 3 burnouts. So each time I had the opportunity to reflect a little bit more why I ended up there and what can I do as an educator in the system. Now looking back or looking just at what is our job in the undergraduate curriculum is to prepare our fellow students to become physician. And we, based on the last 100 years, we put emphasis on knowledge. So actually, all over the world, at one point, we considered that you reached a certain level of knowledge and the society grants you the permission to treat patient. And this decision is left to the physician. Where, when, what's the threshold? But we forgot that being physician is more than knowledge. We have today a tremendous chance to rethink all that in the context of artificial intelligence. Because knowledge, we are not the master of knowledge anymore. We can argue now for 1 or 2 or 3 years or in maybe 5 years. We are just in this transition phase where technology for certain aspect is going to be better than many things we can do as human. If we consider the situation where one artificial intelligence is able to pass a national exam, USMLE in the United States, or we have our national exam too. Does it mean that this artificial intelligence is a physician? Probably not, because there are many more things that are coming with the training and this decision to let you treat patient. And those things were just granted for. So I think education needs to now take care of those aspects that we just said, hey, that's fine, that comes with it. So that's one aspect. The environment, clinical environment, the world changes, and our profession needs to rethink how we decide if someone becomes a physician or not. And it's not knowing by heart all this immense baggage of knowledge. It's more to know how to deal with it. And the other aspect is how to be a physician, not how to act as a physician, but how to be a physician. And I think this is something that is difficult to introduce in the training, because we are so much knowledge focused, and the way we address knowledge is with assessment that are reliable, and we have all the qualities, educational, edumetrical qualities that are attached to those assessment. And for good reason, I think it's very important. The problem I see is that we just focused on that. So we have to open up. We have to look at the other competencies that make a physician be a physician, and try to help our students to develop those qualities in a reflected manner. So this is something that needs a change, because how would you say to a student, based on lack of reflexivity, you're not allowed to continue your studies? You will have a hard fight if you compare that to the knowledge. If someone has all perfect MCQs and no reflectivity, in many situations, many schools, you don't have the tools to tell the student you're not allowed to continue. We know what it means to have a physician without reflection. It's not possible. So how we can introduce that in the training of our student is this new movement that came with understanding what assessment does to the learning and how assessment can contribute to learning and not only measure learning. Mm. So assessment came out of this role of, okay, that's just a measuring tool. And we now consider that when you put an assessment, there's a pre-assessment effect. So that will steer the way students learn. There is a pure assessment effect. Going through an assessment is a learning moment, and there's a post-assessment effect. You may use what the result of your assessment to change or improve your learning afterwards. So it's more than just having a grade. And that's how assessment, for me, joins this reflection of developing other competencies than just knowledge and skills. Because if we find a way in assessment to consider those sometimes contradictory statement of a student, he is good in knowledge but bad in professionalism or so on. If you have on one side the grades, you need the grades on the other side to kind of balance that. Or, and that's this approach, it's to look at the assessment not as a grading machine, but as a teaching machine. So the phrase goes is assessment for learning instead of assessment of learning.
So tell us how you've done this, that in your program have removed grades, at least the way we generally think about grades, and putting all our efforts toward getting the grade, completing the exam, doing well on the exam for the exam's sake, and how you flip that upside down in a sense, and really was about how to make it a reflective process so one can understand where one's strengths are and what one needs to begin to work on and really be invested in doing that work, not just for grade's sake, but for the idea of becoming a clinician, a physician who can actually function well and be well as well.
So the basic concept can be really, and it's really based actually on how you can look at the patient. That means in the clinic, when you have a patient, you have some solid data from the lab. This is calibrated. You have your quality controls and so on. Then you have some interpretation data or the history, physical exam, at a certain point also imagery. And then you have your own feeling when you are with your patient. And this is very soft. And sometimes the lab tells it all. You don't need to go further. It's just so obvious. But that's not always the case. Sometimes the interpretation data gives you enough of information and the lab is just to confirm, but you already know. Sometimes the lab imagery are kind of more or less, you're on the gray zone and there kicks in your experience. Why you say, this patient, I keep this patient overnight here. I don't let him go home. And so you have those different levels of information that you have to manage to take a decision. So the idea in this, what we call the technical term is programmatic assessment, is to not consider assessment in isolation. You look at it as a programmatic assessment, in a way that each measuring point is a point of information. And then when you have enough information, you go to the decision. So that's how basically we were able now here at my university in Fribourg to go without grades. At some university, they do the same approach, but they, for regularity reason, had to keep the grades. But the principle is the same, is that every measuring point, every data of information may have different qualities, like the labs, standardized quality control, like the gut feeling you may have, very subjective, very, but rich in information too. And to combine all that, you take that as a whole picture of your student. And you decide on this picture if your student should continue study or should graduate. So for some students, if they're just so bad in the MCQs, that means they don't have the ground knowledge. You can't figure out how they could be physician or continue to the next year. For some students, it's about the feedbacks they get in the clinic because of certain behaviors they have, certain way they interact with the patient or with other clinician or nurse or physiotherapist or whatever. So it's to get those information at one point, but not with the perspective to grade or not the student. The first perspective is to give the students the information where he should improve. And that's where we can open up and go broader than just knowledge and skills. So knowledge and skills are now in, I would say in competition, but that's not the right word, are now on the same level of what the students should get as a message, what is important for me to learn to become a physician. And that's how we flip that around. It's to go not to add, to close the loop with the analogy of the patient. It would be nonsense in clinic to make kind of a mean score of the different labs you have, and you put a score for the radiology, and then for the history, and then for the, and then if the mean score is above a certain number, you say pass or you say fail, or your patient is okay or patient is not okay. Doesn't make sense. So once you enter this programmatic assessment understanding, you get the same feeling when you have those way of grading and promoting student based on some mean score, or even if you do some adjustments, it's really to get the picture. For some students, you have the problem in the knowledge. Some students is about professionalism. Some students is about different aspects. And sometimes it makes the whole difference.
Yeah, in some ways, I think you're talking about really a culture of medicine change, a culture of medical education. And so that the teaching experience on the wards, for example, would not necessarily reify just knowledge as a way of assessing patients at the bed, students at the bedside, but like you said, like on an equal ground with those other personal, professional qualities, and they're all important, of course. And so that, so it's really a cultural shift. And I'd imagine making that shift has been, it's a growth, and there's growing pains, I would think, in your own experience. Maybe you can share with us over the 4 or 5 years that you've been implementing this, what that's been like for your faculty. Also some outcomes, how has it been for the students? How have they done on standardized measures of performance? And also, what do you know about their well-being and even your faculty well-being in this new world that you're striving or intending to create?
Maybe I will start with the well-being and then transition to the other points. We include in the measuring points we ask from our students that they reflect on their well-being. It's part of professionalism. We define that as commitment to self. This is a quality that every physician should have. And historically, you can go back to the Greeks. You find already those aspects more than 2,000 years ago, this commitment to self. Be well yourself before you treat the others. If you're unwell, you won't be able to treat the others. So for us, it's part of this core aspect of professionalism. And we expect them in the learning report at the end of the year that they reflect on their well-being. And we differentiate, make a difference between self-awareness and self-care. Self-awareness is this professional competence that we expect from our students. Self-care is a private competence, how I will deal with that. And the school has nothing to say to that, except it should be there if needed. So that's the way I found to kind of don't step in the trap to be prescriptive about what students should do for their well-being. So it's really about being aware where they are in this work-life disbalance. I always call that disbalance because the balance is so difficult to achieve that when you don't achieve it, people get the feeling they're missing something or they're not good at it. It's just life that always keeps you out of balance. And the skill is to handle the disbalance. It's not to reach a balance. That's how we talk with our students. And they come out, most of them. Some don't, but that's where they get some feedback. And we expect they do that. They reflect on, okay, that's where I am, and that's my workload, or that's, I just have it. I had 1 month ago, a student came in and said, I'm so sorry, I'm just exhausted. I have such a tough time. We had just 3 deaths in our family. I just can't anymore. My scores are going down. So we don't have grades, but we have scores in our exam. So my scores are going down. I'm so upset about that. And I told her, listen, that's not the important thing to learn for you now, is you should go home and take care about the most important things you can learn now for being a future physician is, what is that for you? What does that mean for you? So take the time you need to care about that and then come back. This is a high-performing student. So I don't have, as the vice dean, I don't have any trouble imagining this person, once she found back, that she will perform good, well again. Should she be penalized at the end of the year because of that? No, because she learned something that we don't measure, but that's so important. So that's the well-being, the way we can include that, because we have this big picture with all those different pixels of information, and each pixel is not a pass or fail. The big picture is. And that is how we work with this well-being. So we have in our training, next week, I will have a half a day with our fifth year student about physician burnout. we address that. We have 4 hours with my colleague in psychiatry where we address a subject like physician burnout, because they are just before the elective year and they will observe things. So we want them to have some tools to think about what they're observing. So they're not just taking that in without being able to handle that in a way or another.
When you say observe things, you mean, are you talking about observing the difficulties of, you know, what it means to really work with patients and how that can affect one's own well-being and burnout, or also what they see among the faculty, the clinicians that actually have been working for a while, and the presence of burnout among them?
Both, actually. I mean, it just, they're entering this profession from being very peripheral in the beginning. They become more and more during the studies until their residents, they become central to this profession. And so they're approaching one step after the other, this clinic, this professional identity of being a physician. What we know is that this professional identity can be, this professional identity is something that just happens, builds up. If you don't, it's not something you have to do. It happens. But what we know is that professional identity can be reflected upon, and probably you can adjust things. So to talk about those things, to be explicit, to explain, my hope is that some students or enough students have some tools to think about what they observe. For example, when they start clinical rotation, when they come back from the first rotation, I ask them a question. What dreams were shattered by what you observed in the last 6 weeks? This happens if you talk or not about it, but that's a way to kind of deal or use their experience to think about, to reflect about, and to see more than this conditioned response to either I put that somewhere aside in deep down in my memory, or it just explodes and I want to stop medicine.
Yeah, I think being transparent about it really allows people to deal with it or learn some skills to deal with it now early. And those skills is really what we're trying to carry into our profession. So because we're going to be facing, as one goes out into the workforce as a practicing clinician, physician, things are going to come up. Things are going to be not exactly the way we want them to be, right? So how are we going to meet that and to learn some of those skills early rather than suppressing it or just saying, I can't deal with this, I'm out, you know? And I think that's a great approach. I know there's been some outcomes reported on your program thus far, and I think our listeners would really love to hear about that. Maybe you can share a little bit about that. And then one other thing, which may be a little more subjective, is what do you know about, because it's so early, what kinds of physicians these students that go through your program are becoming? What are the choices they're making, both in how they comport themselves, but also what they choose to do in medicine? What do you know about that? What's your sense about that? Because it may not be really hard data yet.
Yeah. So the first outcome we have is this kind of hard data measurement of our national licensing exam. It's the equivalent of USMLE Step 2 in the States. And we have the same format as the USMLE used to be. So we have a clinical knowledge on the clinical skills exam. At the clinical knowledge, our students, so we have two cohorts up to now that finished our school and that took the licensing exam. They took position 2 in Switzerland, so high up there. And for the clinical skills exam, we are in the first position both years also. So we have two cohorts that perform very high at those formal exam. And maybe I should also tell that we don't have a special selection in the intake. So it's not, they have to take an exam to enter medical school in whole Switzerland. And depending on the level of performance they have the first, second, or third or fourth choice of school. And we have about 60% of our students that end up in Fribourg because it's not a huge city and so on, as being one of the last priority they put in. And so the choice they had is, I do medicine at this place or I don't do medicine. So many of our students are not the highest performer in these entry tests. But at the end of the training, they're up there. But for me, it's not the main endpoint. It has a huge impact in kind of acceptance of the system we put in without grades. Many people that were fighting against just became quiet because much of the opposition was driven by fear. And when people are afraid, they're not kind, mostly, because that's just the way a human being is. And I had enough experience in curriculum design and reform to know that. And even though it's tough in the moment, you know, you have to bite through until it's established. And that was a great gift that those two courts offered us to have those performance. But for me, the main aspect was just pass the exam, because my endpoint as educator is how you live your first year as resident. And this is something we didn't have time for the moment to dig into because of resources. We still are stabilizing our curriculum. But from the talks, the exchange I have with our former students, they are, I find, pretty well into it. They're well-oriented in clinic. They're very productive compared to some other students. That's the feedback I get also from the clinicians. But then again, they know whom they're talking to, and that may be biased. Mm-hmm. So it's maybe wishful thinking. But on another side, what I observed is that some students tell, oh, I'm so exhausted by the training, I take 1 year off before I start. And they do that with the clear understanding why they do that. It's not kind of out of despair. So again, anecdotes, but some of the students I talked to with this decision, that was very well reflected. And this is something I was not used to prior students I had at my other university before, because that was kind of out of exhaustion. They just couldn't do anymore, or they would just say, I will survive and I go into that. But this is something we will try to go after in the coming years to see how they perform in the sense of being physician. That's my focus more than performing and practicing or performing as a resident in the sense of can they do this and that and that.
Yeah, and I think it will be very enlightening, and I think it's worth trying to capture that. The methodologies to capture that are probably going to be challenging, but it sounds like you're up for that challenge. As you're speaking and talking about this and also describing, you kind of have to have a thick skin, or at least not take things personally. What is it about you? What is it about your qualities that has allowed you to persevere in really what is kind of a sea change, even though it may seem incremental? It's not at all. It's quite a shift in how medical education prepares for this new world, really, of truly being a physician, knowing that knowledge is just one part of something, and we're not necessarily going to be the masters of the access to that knowledge any longer. What are we master of? So yeah, what was it about you that just kind of drove you to persevere and stay with it? And also, I'm assuming, and you can tell me whether this is true or not, and to what extent it's true, it brings you joy and meaning, helps you flourish.
For me, I think one of my quality, if I would compare me to a plant, I would be kind of a pioneer plant. You know, those plants that grow in an environment where it's difficult. I'm probably not the kind of plant that flourishes in a ground where everything is already growing. That's my drive to bring some innovation at the points where I think it's needed. And this is all my career. I mean, I made 3 curriculum changes, and this is the 4th one. That was not a change. That was a new construction. So, yeah, that was pretty much all over my career to bring innovation, to try to make things move forward. So that's maybe one quality. The other is I probably get it pretty much what is experiential and too much and what is innovative and feasible. And this is a difficult line to find. And I'm very open to exchange and looking into experience. And the green light in my head in doing that was after having visited Cleveland Clinic School, because they have a very similar curriculum, but they have 20 years of experience. And I went there. They were kind enough to host me for 2 days. I had many interviews. When I came out of those 2 days, I said, it's feasible. We don't have the environment of Cleveland Clinics. We are a public school, so funding is very different. We have a very small clinic, hospital, so we don't have this huge number of physicians. So, but I came out of Cleveland with the profound understanding it's feasible, and I stick to that. So that was maybe my quality, to be able to exchange, try to find what's pushing and what's over pushing. And so I think that's important, especially if you are so early in the wave of a change. And there are many changes that are nothing, but I think this one is profound and it functions.
I would agree. I think it is profound. And from what I saw on my visit recently, it is functioning. And another thing that I saw quality that I noticed about you is that you're a joy to be around. You like to have fun and you're open to new experiences. You just shared about that. So maybe as we close this conversation, if you can just talk about what is it you like to do for fun, that you intentionally say, this is what I want to go have fun. What do you do?
Well, I grew up in the mountains, in the Alps. So for me, where I really feel home is when I'm out in the mountains, in the forest, or above the forest, and just walking. So this is where I'm home. I can walk for days and just happy. So this is for the summertime. And in the wintertime, I'm going to hit the slopes. I love to do snowboard technique called extreme carving. I mean, I do snowboard since 1985. And so I was a very early adopter again. He also. That was the time where they forbid us to go on the slopes because they were afraid we're going to destroy the ski slopes. But so at that time, that was doing really off-piste boarding, but we don't have that quality of snow anymore. So I changed and I do extreme carve on the slopes. And this is, my body isn't up to the high level I would like to, but I enjoyed immensely to just do some lay down there and go through that. So this is where I really get my energy, is somewhere out in the mountains. And then if possible with the family also, to share the moment together. And
Lovely, lovely. I did want to bring out one point, which I must say, I have to differ with you. You talk about the students and their choices. And, you know, in North America, we think of Switzerland, we think of the Alps, we'll think of Geneva, we'll think of Zurich, we'll think of Lausanne, those places. But having been to Fribourg, I think it's a secret destination. It is a beautiful destination. So for any of the listeners out there who want to see a beautiful quintessential part of Switzerland and really feel welcomed and at home, Fribourg is just a beautiful place. So thank you. Anything else, Raphael, that you'd like our listeners? You know, we hope the listenership will grow to include not just clinicians out there practicing, but educators, students as well. So any other messages you'd like to give?
Maybe two messages. One is about Fribourg. Our students come with a tear in the eye because, but they leave with a tear in the eyes.
Ah, that's lovely.
So it's the experience of Fribourg is really nice. Maybe my message is to think about being the person you are. And try to explore what it means if you think about yourself, not in terms of doing things, but being. Be gentle with you on that journey.
Thank you. Thank you. This has been wonderful.
Thanks very much for listening. We will include a summary of today's podcast and links about Dr. Bonvin and other references that were discussed in the show notes. I'd like to conclude by sharing another practical exercise to help you flourish during your workday, and to add to others that I've already shared with you in prior episodes, to a toolbox, you could say, of skills that you can draw upon to enhance purpose, meaning, and well-being. Dr. Van Vaughn today spoke about skills of reflection and even emphasizing how challenging, actually impossible, it would be to practice medicine without this skill. Another aspect of reflection includes looking at oneself. In our contemplative practices, we ask ourselves to bring awareness to aspects of our experience, whether they're somatic, like body sensation, or affective, like how we're feeling, or cognitive, the thoughts we're having. This brief practice requires a simple mirror, or you can use your smartphone. So standing in front of the mirror, or holding the smartphone in front of your face and turning the camera on and setting it as if you're taking a selfie so you can be looking at yourself. And spending about 30 seconds or so, that's all this meditation exercise takes. You can time it if you'd like. Spending about 30 seconds simply looking, seeing, noticing. You may find this odd, different, difficult, as judgments may arise, emotions may show up, or even certain sensations in the body may become prominent. That's all okay. And of course, you're not actually seeing yourself. What you're actually seeing is a reflection of yourself, capturing some features, but not all of you. So see if you can do this, finishing this exercise with a small smile, or a big smile if you'd like. If you can, and just notice the effect it has on your experience, effect it has on your body sensations, your emotions, even thoughts that you're having. I hope you found this podcast and this simple exercise useful to you, and look forward to having you join us for the next episode of Flourishing in Medicine, From Surviving to Thriving. This podcast has been brought to you by MPRO. Its technical director is Stan Sejour, and its producer and the vice president of education at MPRO is Jerry Donahue. If you'd like to learn more about MPRO, please visit www.mympro.com. If you'd like to know more about MPRO's peer support programs, please visit www.mympro.com/peer-support. If you're a physician or medical student and in need of urgent support, please consider calling the physician support line at 1-888-409-0141 or visit www.physiciansupportline.com. The physician support line provides a safe space to discuss immediate life stressors with volunteer psychiatrists, colleagues, who are uniquely trained in mental wellness and also have similar shared experience of being a health professional. For more information about me and my work, please visit www.mickkrasnermd.com or www.mindfulpracticeinmedicine.com. Hope to see you next time.